Okay, is that you standing in the window?
Yes, yes.
Okay, I want you to come out right now.
In times of peril, we rely on police to come to our aid swiftly and effectively when we call the emergency number. These numbers exist to ensure our safety and provide us with a sense of security. However, what happens when the system created to help people fails? In 2008, an incident in Madison, Wisconsin, called into question the reliability of such a system. Brittany Zimmerman was born on the 15th of November 1986 to parents Kevin and Jean in Marshfield Wood County, Wisconsin. Then in 1992, Kevin and Jean welcomed a little baby boy who they named Matthew. Brittany took on the role of protective big sister with ease. From a young age, she was driven and had an unwavering desire to work in the medical research field. This ambition was evident during her freshman year at Marshfield High School, and she knew that achieving her goal would require hard work and dedication. In an effort to see her dreams materialize, Brittany met frequently with her guidance counselor, Liz Dostal, who recalled of her. She was a very precocious freshman girl, very concerned about her learning and picking the right courses to prepare her. We had many conversations. She wanted to succeed. She always talked about wanting to be a physician, and she was not daunted by the challenges. Brittany excelled academically, graduating in the top 10% of her class with 8 advanced placement classes under her belt. She also found time to be involved in extracurricular activities, such as playing in the school band, participating in the Spanish Club and National Honor Society, and volunteering at the American Cancer Society Hope Lodge. After high school, Brittany enrolled at the University of Wisconsin to pursue a degree in medical microbiology and immunology. Her compassionate nature and desire to make a difference in the world led her to choose this field of study. Brittany was known for her kindness and generosity towards others, often giving a dollar to a homeless person without a second thought. As her aunt, Kim Hegg, recalled, she's the kind of girl who gives a dollar to the homeless guy. During her time at the university, Brittany worked in the office of the Register, where she displayed her meticulous organizational skills by developing a system to scan and index student records and documents. Her supervisor, Joanne Berg, was impressed by her work ethic and positive attitude. She stated, "It was tedious work, but she didn't complain. In fact, she had fun with it." Despite her busy schedule, Brittany still found time to enjoy the company of her loved ones. She was a bubbly and spirited young woman who loved spending time with her close friends and family. Her interests included playing tennis, reading, jet skiing, and playing the card game Sequence. She was particularly close with her mother, speaking to her on the phone multiple times a day, and she enjoyed fishing with her father. The year before Brittany enrolled at the university, she met Jordan Gonnering, and the two quickly fell in love. Jordan transferred to the University of Wisconsin from UW-Stevens Point to be closer to Brittany. They moved into a charming apartment on 517 West Doughty Street, with a light green exterior and a white wood framed front porch. Brittany and Jordan shared a passion for cats, and they had 3 furry companions, Boo, Felix, and Marv. They even talked about marriage and having children, with plans to tie the knot in Hawaii. The 2nd of April 2008 started like any regular day for Brittany. That morning, she pulled on blue jeans, a lime green wool coat, and black Puma tennis shoes, and walked to class. At around 11:30 a.m., she left school and returned home, walking along North Bedford, South Bedford, and then onto West Doughty Street. She arrived back home shortly after 11:30 a.m. Around an hour later, a 911 call came into police. When the operator answered, there was nobody else on the other end of the line. Chillingly, however, a woman could be heard screaming in the background, followed by the sound of a struggle. The 911 operator determined the location of the caller in just 24 seconds. But after hearing nobody speak, she hung up and then failed to ring back. At around 1 p.m, Jordan was returning to the apartment he shared with Brittany. As he approached the door on the outside of the building, he observed fresh marks. It appeared as though somebody had forced open the door. He slowly proceeded through the apartment, calling out Brittany's name, only to be met with silence. He then entered the bedroom and found Brittany on the floor, surrounded in a puddle of blood. He immediately called 911.
911, what's the address of the emergency? 911, what's the address of the emergency?
Hello?
This is 911, what's the address of the emergency?
517 West Doty Street.
Repeat it?
517 West Doty Street.
Is there an apartment number?
The flat.
It's what? You're cutting out. Can you hear me? Hello?
Hello.
Okay, your phone's cutting out. Did you say upper or lower flat?
Yes.
Which?
It's the lower flat, apartment one.
Okay.
Ambulance is needed.
Okay, what's the phone number you're calling from, please?
715-305-2584.
Okay, what is your name?
Jordan Gonnering.
Okay, tell me exactly what happened.
I just came home, the door was busted in, and my girlfriend's been shot.
Okay. Stay on the phone with me. Okay?
Yep.
Are you with her right now?
Yes, I am.
How old is she?
She is 19. No, she's 21.
21? Is she conscious?
No, she's not.
Okay, stay on the phone, okay? Are you safe where you are right now?
I think so.
He said to the 911 operator that it looked as though Brittany had been shot. He was told to look into her mouth and see whether anything was obstructing her breathing. He said that she was cold to the touch and that her fingers were stiff.
Okay, stay on the phone with me so I can tell you how to help her, okay? I want you to get as close to her with the phone as you can, okay?
Yes.
Okay. And then, you're right by her now?
Yes.
All right, I want you to lay her flat on her back on the ground.
Yep.
Remove any pillows.
Okay.
I need you to kneel next to her and look in her mouth for any food or vomit. Did you think she did this herself?
No, she couldn't have.
She couldn't have done it herself?
No, it's gunshot wounds.
Hold on. Okay, just so you know, there's an ambulance on the way and the officers are on the way as well, okay?
Okay.
And I'm also talking to them at the same time. Okay, is that you standing in the window?
Yes.
Okay, I want you to come out right now.
Yep.
So they can get in there to help her, okay?
Yep. Okay. All right, he told me to hang out with the officer.
Okay, bye.
All right, bye.
Detectives were immediately dispatched to Brittany's apartment, and they were let in by Jordan, who was crying, trembling, and in a state of shock. He commented to Detective Marion Morgan. She was the nicest person ever. Who would do this? Detective Morgan proceeded into the bedroom where she found Brittany motionless on the floor, with a pool of blood around her. She was well beyond resuscitation efforts and was pronounced dead at the scene. As Brittany's body was transported to the medical examiner's office, City Council President Mike Fearver asked the community to remain vigilant. He stated, This absolutely could be random, and the murderer is still at large. The police are working feverishly, looking at leads. Detectives followed suit and held a press conference asking students and residents to use caution in the area. Over at the medical examiner's office, it was discovered that Brittany hadn't been shot dead like Jordan had thought, but instead, she had been stabbed, strangled, and beaten. She died of complex homicidal violence, including multiple stab wounds and strangulation. The stab wounds were inflicted with a knife that was about 2 to 5 inches long, with a width of about 3/4 of an inch. Nearly half of the stab wounds were to Brittany's heart. Detectives investigating Brittany's murder made a public announcement, revealing that they were considering all potential suspects and connections to other unsolved cases. They didn't discount the possibility that the murder was linked to the January stabbing of Joel Marino, who was killed in his apartment on South Park Street. They also hadn't ruled out that it was somehow linked to the abduction of University of Wisconsin student Kelly Nolan, who was abducted in June the year beforehand in downtown Madison, and then found dead in Oregon, Wisconsin. In an effort to gather more information, detectives urged the public to come forward with any tips or leads that could assist in their investigation. Police Chief Noble Ray stated, "It is so vitally important that if anybody saw anything, observed anything, heard anything, that they would contact the Madison Police Department." At the crime scene, forensic experts collected multiple DNA swabs, fingerprints, and partial footwear prints. Detectives also searched the surrounding neighborhood for any evidence that could lead to the killer, including potential items of bloody clothing or even the murder weapon. The University of Wisconsin took measures to increase campus safety, calling on students to work together and assist in the investigation. They urged students to use the university's safety resource to avoid walking alone at night and to take additional precautions, such as locking doors and windows. The university offered counseling services to those affected by the tragedy. Dean of Students, Lori Bearcombe, stated, "It's a bright sunny day out there and people are out and about. We're hoping to call to arms as a community to try and find out what happened." Lori further urged students to pay attention to their personal safety and said they should make use of the university's safe resources, such as Safe Walk and Safe Ride, to avoid walking alone at night. Extra precautions were also made for students, including increased security patrols, especially at night. In addition, students were told to keep a deadbolt on their doors, and during warm weather, to not open up their windows past 4 inches to prevent any intruders from entering. They were also encouraged not to include their names on cell phone voicemail greetings and only leave their last name on mailboxes. The university also announced that they were prepared to help anybody who may need assistance in coping with the tragedy. They offered counselors through the university's website and the Dean of Students' office. The shocking murder left the entire community on edge, particularly other students who feared for their own safety. The possibility that the killer may have targeted Brittany specifically was a frightening thought, but the uncertainty of whether the murder was random or not was equally terrifying, leaving everyone on edge and questioning their own safety. Andrew Berg, who lived near Brittany, said, "It definitely makes you think twice, you know, walking home from the bars and stuff at night. The neighborhood is known for sketchy people, but not anything like this. It doesn't hit home until, God, right across the street." The next day, detectives announced that Jordan, Brittany's boyfriend, was not a suspect in her murder. He had been left devastated and inconsolable, but he was doing everything he could to assist the detectives in their investigation. Meanwhile, back at the crime scene, the collection of evidence had been completed, and it had been sent to the Wisconsin State Crime Lab for analysis. Lieutenant Joe Balls emphasized that the process for analyzing the evidence was far more complex than what was typically depicted on crime shows, like CSI. He stressed the importance of taking their time and not rushing to any conclusions. Detectives had reason to believe that the perpetrator of the crime was still in the downtown neighborhood where Brittany's body was discovered. Lieutenant Balls expressed this belief, stating that the person responsible for the murder was still in the area, most likely. As part of their investigation, detectives were questioning everyone who knew Brittany to determine if there was someone who had a motive to harm her. However, according to her aunt Kim Haig, Brittany was loved by everybody and had no enemies. She only wanted to do good in the world. In an attempt to identify a person of interest, detectives turned their attention towards the transient population in the downtown area. They discovered that several break-ins and attempted burglaries had occurred in the same area on the same day as Brittany's murder. City Council President Verveer suggested that most of these types of crimes were committed by people in the transient population who were looking to fuel their addictions. This decision faced some criticism, with some accusing the detectives of unfairly stigmatizing the transient community. Rachel Krinsky, executive director of the Interfaith Hospitality Network, expressed concerns that this would reinforce harmful stereotypes about homeless people. She stated, "It sets a bad precedent for the community to immediately blame the homeless for violent acts, and it reinforced stereotypes. I respect very much the police department's need to do their job well, and I appreciate the fact the need to investigate. This is an incredibly tragic and devastating crime. If there is evidence or if they have some motive or reason to believe that a homeless person did this, then they should certainly follow that inquiry. It does homeless people and the agencies that help them and the community a disservice to have splashed all over the media an assumption that this violence is perpetrated by homeless people." Despite the backlash, some members of the community believed that it was time for a crackdown on transient people in Madison. The city was known for being welcoming to the homeless, with daily congregations in the Capitol basement for meals and panhandling on street corners. However, this welcoming nature had also attracted more homeless people, some of whom were apparently becoming increasingly aggressive. Ultimately, the detectives continued their investigation, with the goal of finding the perpetrator of Brittany's murder. Lieutenant Bale stated, "We've kind of institutionalized an enabling environment downtown for this transient population to grow unchecked. They're downtown preying largely off that student population and really preying off a lot of our good compassion. In a way, they are taking advantage of us." Detectives had a strong lead that pointed them towards the transient community as they investigated Brittany's murder. The suspicion was fueled by accounts of two neighbors who reported similar encounters with a man knocking on their door on April 3rd, just blocks away from where Brittany was killed. One neighbor recounted a man asking for $40 to fix a flat tire while standing at their front door, and the other heard a knock but chose not to open the door. Another resident on West Washington Avenue reported that a man had walked into her home, climbed up the stairs and asked for $40 to fix a flat tire parked at East Washington Avenue. She requested that he leave, and he complied. This event occurred only half an hour before Brittany's body was discovered. Similarly, a woman living on West Dottie Street heard someone frantically ringing her doorbell around the same time, and then observed an older man with grey hair walking away from her door as she opened it. Given Brittany's friendly and compassionate nature, detectives theorized that this man had knocked on Brittany's door asking for help with his flat tire, and she opened it up to offer help and was possibly killed. While this was being investigated, on the 7th of April, around 200 members of the community came together to remember Brittany during a candlelight vigil and memorial service. Friends and family addressed the crowd to talk about the kind of person that Brittany was. Her friend Whitney Krogman stated, "She was the straightest arrow ever." She described her as level-headed and down-to-earth. Her lab partner said that she always came to class with a smile on her face, and she loved to talk about her three cats. Dean of Students, Lori, said that it was important to keep the light of Britney alive. She stated, "This world is robbed of someone who could have been an amazing leader, a gifted woman, a giving community member, and we acknowledge that, and we know that. And we have to grieve that as a community. We have to link arms for strength. This is a time on campus we will all come together as a family." Britney's aunt Mary Lay referred to her as our angel and said that she left the world knowing love. She stated, "She had love every day from her family and from her friends. She loved everything and everyone." After the service, Britney's family set up a Dollars for Britney scholarship fund in her honour. In a statement they stated, "In the day since Britney's tragic death, we have searched our hearts for answers that we may never achieve. We are grieving her death and we are grieving the future events that we'll never celebrate with Britney." They said that given Britney's determination in academics, they felt as though the best way to honour her was to establish a scholarship fund in her name. They wanted the scholarship to go towards someone who had the drive, determination, and energy that Britney had, but lacked the tools to accomplish this dream on their own. Detectives were still looking into the possibility that Britney was killed by somebody who was soliciting money. They appealed to the public to get in contact if they were solicited by someone looking for money, or if they gave money to a stranger the day that Britney was killed or the day before. A police spokesman stated, "This would include citizens who were approached on the streets or in their homes by one or more individuals." They identified a number of transient people that they wished to speak to. Their investigation led them to a homeless man named David Call. David told detectives that he was the man who was seeking $40 to fix the flat tire on his non-existent car on the day that Britney was killed. He admitted that he was on crack cocaine and that this was a scheme to get money to fund his addiction. He said that in the days before Britney's murder, the scheme had netted him around $500. David said that on the same day there were two other homeless men that he knew from the square who were breaking into homes and running scams. He identified these two men as Hank and Mitchell and said that they had been taking drugs at a place he described as a crack house on Wilson Street, and then they separated. He stated, "I also know they were going into houses that were unsecured and stealing things like cell phones and laptop computers." David was a convicted sex offender. In 1993, he was convicted of second-degree sexual assault and pleaded no contest and was sentenced to a year in prison. After he was tracked down by detectives investigating Britney's murder, he was arrested on suspicion of violating his probation and was considered a material witness in Britney's murder. Detectives stressed that David was a witness, not a suspect, and he helped them to develop a composite sketch of one of the homeless men, and then went with detectives to a homeless shelter to see if he could spot Hank or Mitchell. After David provided detectives with this information, the State Department of Corrections announced that they were wanting him to return to prison for a year. They wanted to revoke his extended supervision on a previous sentence for fifth-time drunk driving and failure to register as a sex offender. David had also concocted a scheme with a woman to scam $4,000 from the Social Security Administration. He admitted that he knew that he had been overpaid by Social Security, with an $8,000 deposit going into a bank account controlled by his mother. He got a woman to pose as his mother so that they could withdraw $4,000 from the account to buy crack cocaine. Judge Patrick Fielder said that there was more than enough reason to put David back behind bars, citing his crack cocaine habit, bank fraud, writing worthless checks and soliciting money from strangers by falsely telling them of car trouble. He stated, "These behaviours certainly put the public at risk. The magnitude of Mr. Cal's addiction requires more intensive treatment, which can be provided if he is confined." Detectives said that the information provided by David was just something that they were looking into, and that neither he, Hank, or Mitchell were considered suspects, although they were still trying to track Hank and Mitchell down. Detective stressed that they had interviewed hundreds of people in the investigation, and that none of them rose to a level higher than the others. A police spokesman stated, "In general, we've talked to hundreds of people in the course of this investigation. Many of them we'd consider witnesses in that they saw some things in and around the Bassett neighbourhood on the day of the crime. None rise to a higher level than the others. We have not formed an interest in one person, two people, or a group of people." While the investigation continued, it was revealed to the public that the silent 911 call that had preceded Jordan's 911 call had come from Brittany. Even more disturbing, police and county dispatchers attempted to intentionally withhold this information. It wasn't until a local newspaper reported on it that they finally admitted that it was true. While they did admit that the 911 call had come from Brittany, they refused to give details of what was heard on the call. They knew that if it came out that Brittany could be heard screaming for her life in the call, the criticism would have been exponential. Dane County Public Safety Communications Director Joseph Norick stated, "The dispatcher didn't call back. It was waiting in the queue and intended to get back to it later." He said that since the call had come from a cell phone, it couldn't be determined where it was coming from, so nobody was sent out. However, that was a lie. It later came out that the call was traced within 24 seconds. Police Chief Ray said that it was too early to know whether a better response could have prevented Brittany's murder or helped to catch her killer. However, he did admit to the public that the 911 centre didn't call Brittany back, and they didn't notify police to send out an officer. Under the department's policy, the dispatcher is required to call the number back on silent phone calls. The police chief then disputed what Dane County Public Safety Communications Director said, and confirmed that the dispatchers do have the technology to pinpoint the location of cell phone calls. However, the 911 director, Joseph, then admitted that his agency had made a mistake in fumbling the call. He said that hindsight was a great thing, admitted that it was policy for the 911 operator to call back, but that never happened. The Dane County 911 Centre conducted an internal investigation. While this was ongoing, County Executive Kathleen Falk wrote an apology to Brittany's family and Jordan. She said that the 911 operator had made two procedural errors. She did not alert law enforcement of the call, and she didn't call back. However, she further said that if protocol had have been followed, she didn't believe it would have been enough to save Brittany. The 911 operator, Rita Gagan, hit back and denied that she had hung up on Brittany. She claimed that Brittany had hung up on her. After the internal review, it was announced that an external review was going to be conducted. Meanwhile, detectives announced that they didn't believe that Brittany's murder was connected to the earlier murder of Joel Marino. It had been discovered that he was killed by a former student named Adam Peterson, who admitted to the murder. He pleaded guilty to that murder and took his life shortly before sentencing, but there was nothing to indicate that he was involved in Brittany's murder as well. Then in June, it was announced that Brittany's family had filed a federal lawsuit against Dane County and the 911 operator who handled her phone call. They claimed that negligence contributed to Brittany's murder and that they were seeking unspecified damages. They also referred to a 2004 report from a Seattle consulting firm that advised that the 911 centre had serious deficiencies, including understaffing and inadequate supervision. By this point, the 911 call hadn't been publicly released, and several media companies had filed lawsuits for it to be released to the public. Brittany's parents, Kevin and Jean, intervened and requested the call themselves. While they were attempting to have the call released, Dane County announced changes in their 911 policy. Going forward, 911 calls made from cell phones would be forwarded immediately to police. Under previous policy, police wouldn't be dispatched if the 911 operator couldn't determine whether there was an emergency. Just the following month, Kevin and Jean dropped their lawsuit against Dane County and Rita, the 911 operator. Instead, they filed a fresh lawsuit against the owner of the apartment where Brittany was killed. In the lawsuit, it was revealed that Jordan had complained about a lack of secure doors at their apartment before the murder. The building was owned by Wisconsin Management Company Incorporated. They were named in the lawsuit, along with their insurer, General Casualty. Kevin and Jane had been told by detectives that Brittany's killer had easily kicked in the hollow core door with a cheap lock, and then kicked in her bedroom door with the same ease. The killer had also been able to get into the apartment unit's front door within the building without damaging it. In September, a $5,000 reward was put forward from the Carol Sund Carrington Memorial Foundation for information that could lead to the arrest and conviction of Brittany's killer. During a press conference, a statement written by Kevin and Jane was read aloud by Kim. It read in part, "The past 5 months have been agonizing, and today we still have no answers as to who took our daughter from us. The days since Brittany's death have been very dark, and we're desperate to find justice for our daughter." Police Chief Ray said that the department had done everything possible to identify a suspect, and revealed that several hundred people had been interviewed in the investigation, that had taken them as far away as Virginia and Texas. He added that stranger homicides are often the most difficult to solve, but said that that had not lessened their resolve to bring justice for Brittany. That same month, Joe Norick, the 911 director, resigned. He had come under heavy criticism for how the 911 call was handled. His resignation came just as the executive announced plans to fully fund the replacement of the 911 center's computer dispatch system. She recommended borrowing $2 million for the replacement in her 2009 capital budget. Jean spoke publicly to the Wisconsin State Journal for the first time since her daughter's murder on the 11th of October, after months of mourning in silence. She said that healing couldn't begin until there was justice for her daughter. She said that she was wanting to speak publicly in an effort to draw more attention to the reward fund. She poignantly stated, "She was truly my life. It almost feels like it's still a nightmare. You relive it every single day." In an effort to draw more attention to the case and the reward fund, Jean and her husband, Kevin, took it upon themselves to put up posters in the downtown neighborhood where Brittany was killed. They were not alone in their efforts. Lou Marino, the father of Joel, the other student who had been killed before, joined them to lend his support and understanding of their suffering. Despite the reward fund having reached $13,000, Brittany's loved ones were disappointed that detectives had not distributed any flyers or contributed any funds to the reward themselves. The family were frustrated by the lack of information about the case and feared that not enough was being done to catch Brittany's killer. Jane expressed her disappointment by stating, "Brittany was so let down by everybody. We need to do everything we can. I can't just sit at home anymore." 6 months had now passed since Brittany was killed, and the case remained unsolved with only two full-time detectives working on it. Others were following up on tips and leads, but the family were anxious that progress was slow. The detectives were keeping their cards close to their chest, leaving the family to wonder if enough was being done to find Brittany's killer. In November, Dane County's 911 center was hit with more criticism when they failed to dispatch police to Madison's Lake Edge Park after receiving two separate phone calls reporting an altercation and a loud noise. When they were finally dispatched 90 minutes later, after a third phone call, they found 37-year-old Mark Johnson. He had died from multiple head wounds and chest trauma. This only raised more questions about the reliability of the system designed to protect citizens. In the same month, a media attorney was granted permission to listen to Brittany's 911 call, but the judge ruled that he couldn't disclose its contents to his client or anyone else. Judge Richard Neese postponed ruling on whether to make the tape public, but in early December he decided against releasing it. Despite this decision, the public learned that Brittany had been heard screaming during the call, which had lasted 57 seconds. The details of the call and Brittany's cause of death were released to the public without prior notification of the family, causing distress. The contents of the 911 call raised an alarming question. How could the 911 operator have failed to detect that an emergency was taking place and alert the police. The operator, Rita, claimed that she hadn't heard anything during the call. But the recording clearly captured the sounds of screams and a struggle. Rita explained that the environment was noisy at the 911 centre, and multiple things were happening, making it challenging to hear the screams and the sound of the struggle, even though they were audible on the recording. Despite the obvious flaws and unanswered questions, the centre refused to investigate further, and instead focused on staffing and equipment improvements to minimise the risk of future errors. Rita was interviewed by detectives, and she admitted that she did hear screams, but said that she hadn't registered them as an indication of distress. She then claimed that she only heard background noise, which she couldn't identify as a struggle or a call for help. Following the release of the 911 call details, Rita was suspended for mishandling the call and ordered to serve a 3-day suspension without pay from her current job as a county child support clerk. She had already transferred from the 911 centre after the incident. Initially, Kevin and Jean wanted the 911 call to be released, but they changed their minds and requested that it remain private, citing their desire for people to remember Brittany's beautiful and amazing personality. The judge agreed with their request and refused to release the 911 call to the public. Early the next year, the union that represented Rita announced that they were challenging her suspension. Around the same time, Kevin, Jean, and Jordan filed a lawsuit against Dean County, alleging that negligence led to Brittany's murder. They accused County Executive Kathleen Falk of failing to properly staff and equip the 911 dispatch centre and accused Rita of not following proper procedures. It was revealed that back in March of 2004, MTG Management Consultants had sent Kathleen a reformation plan advising her to update the centre's outdated equipment. Although the computer programs used to indicate the location of cell phone calls placed at the call centres was outdated, she ignored the request. The family's attorney, Robert Elliott, stated, "The family believes that the county was negligent in handling the call and had, for quite some time, known about the problems of the 911 call centre and done nothing about it." On the 2nd of April 2009, the one-year anniversary of Brittany's murder rolled around. To mark the sombre event, a memorial ceremony was held at the university, where the tower bells rang 21 times, one ring for each year of her life. In June, Judge Marianne Sumi ruled that Dean County was not legally bound to follow the recommendations of a 911 consultant's report, which meant that they couldn't be sued by the family. However, this left the claim against Dean County and Rita for mishandling the 911 call. The months continued to trickle past with no new developments in the case, and Brittany's loved ones were left to pick up the pieces of their lives. In November, they placed ads on a billboard in Madison, as well as ones inside Metro Transit buses. The reward fund had now reached $15,000, and the billboards were funded by Adams Outdoor Advertising. In July the next year, the family were struck with another setback, when a judge ruled that the negligence lawsuit should be halted, pending release of evidence from the investigation. They then ruled that Jordan couldn't sue authorities for mishandling the 911 call or the landlords because he didn't have the legal standing. The 3-judge panel said that it was bound by past Wisconsin Supreme Court decisions that narrowly defines the category of family members who can bring such claims to those related only by blood or marriage. Since Jordan was Brittany's fiancé, he didn't fall into that category. Kevin and Jean then announced that they wouldn't be pursuing the wrongful death claim, and instead would focus on a claim that the county was responsible for emotional distress that Brittany had suffered before her death. Dean County subsequently settled the lawsuit and offered to contribute $5,000 towards the reward fund, and would pay the family's lawyer $2,500. Eventually, The months transformed into years, and periodically Brittany's family pleaded for help in the case. It wasn't until February of 2016 when there was a massive development in the case. Brittany's family announced the DNA found at the crime scene had matched somebody. However, they said that they were not announcing that person's name because the district attorney's office said that they weren't yet ready to file charges. They released a statement which read in part, "We have known of the match for some time and were hopeful that things would come together and an arrest would be made. We are confident that there are multiple persons that have been in the prison system in the past and may have detailed information about Brittany's murder that this person revealed to them. We are asking that those with some information they believe may be some help to the investigation come forward. We are aware of someone who has this type of information, but for some unimaginable reason, has chosen to keep this to themselves." 3 months later, that man was finally identified. It was David Kahl, the man who admitted to scamming people for $40 on the same day that Brittany was killed. The DNA had been found on an item of clothing that Brittany was wearing at the time of her murder. While looking into David Kahl as a suspect, detectives spoke with a man named Andrew Scholes, who was serving a 20-month sentence at Gilmer Federal Correctional Institution for gun possession by a felon. During an interview with Scholes, he told detectives that he and Kahl were close. So close, in fact, that he referred to him as his brother. He then shockingly told detectives that Kahl had told him exactly what happened to Brittany. He stated, "I can tell you that Dave broke down in tears one morning and confessed to me what had happened, if I can remember right." However, he then refused to elaborate any further without getting some kind of deal in exchange. At the time, Kahl was also in prison, but in Dodge Correctional Institution. He had been living in Madison after serving a 2-year prison sentence for his 6th drunk driving offence, but was sent back to prison after he was arrested for his 7th offence. He had crashed his car into a power pole and then fled from the area. Scholes then said to detectives that he would provide more information, but only if 2 felony convictions were expunged from his criminal record. He appeared in court and stated, "I don't want to play these games, but I don't see what choice I have." These convictions were a marijuana possession conviction and a possession of firearms conviction. His request was met with criticism from Jean, Brittany's mother, who stated, "He has a daughter himself. If what happened to Brittany happened to his daughter, he'd be doing the same thing I'm doing, but he refuses to do it and I don't understand why not." Over the years, David Kahl had been interviewed several times and he told varying accounts of the day of Brittany's murder. Sometimes he said he had been at her apartment, and sometimes he said he wasn't sure if he was at her apartment because he was high at the time. In the end, his DNA was obtained from a letter that he had sent from prison to police, claiming that another inmate had killed Brittany. Scholes was released from prison while the legal battle ensued regarding his potential presidential pardon. However, in August of 2017, the case hit another bump in the road when he died in a motorcycle crash. It wasn't until the 20th of March 2020 that David Kahl was finally arrested in connection with Brittany's murder. Kahl was ordered to be held on $1 million bail and was ordered to undergo a psychiatric evaluation. His attorney said that recent medical episodes raised questions about whether he had the ability to assist in his defence, and in June he was found to be competent. On the 27th of October 2022, David Kahl appeared in court, where he pleaded guilty to first-degree intentional homicide.
"And are you pleading guilty because you did intentionally cause the death of Brittany Zimmerman?"
"Yes, Your Honor."
Kahl's defense attorney, Ben Gonring, said that after a long series of meetings and a lot of soul-searching, Kahl decided he wanted to let go of a secret that he had been keeping for 14 and a half years. He revealed that on the day that Brittany was killed, Cal was going door to door running scams. He said that when he got to Brittany's apartment, he was already high. Brittany had welcomed him into her apartment and handed him $40 for his non-existent flat tire. Cal then went into the bathroom, and when he came out, he saw that Brittany was on her cell phone. It was at this stage that Cal launched his attack. His defense attorney stated, he basically lost it, for lack of a better phrase. He was in the throes of a lot of drug usage and was paranoid and had not been out of prison for all that long and very worried about what was happening on the other end of the line, and then proceeded to do acts which absolutely fit the criteria for first-degree intentional homicide. His defense attorney then added, he certainly didn't go there with the intent to kill somebody or harm somebody, and she was kind. The evidence has always been clear that she was a kind-hearted person, and was that day. As it was revealed, detectives had recorded a phone call between David Cal and his mother, in which he described the murder in more detail. He stated, all I know is I was in the bathroom and when I came out she was on the phone and I snapped. She was trying to call 911 and I got behind her after I knocked the phone out of her hand and then I took her to the bedroom, threw her down on the bed and then I grabbed a t-shirt and I strangled her. He said that when he realized Brittany wasn't dead, he stabbed her 19 times. In his confession, he also blamed the 911 center and said that they absolutely could have saved her. David Cal agreed before sentencing to forego any argument on his behalf, asking that he be considered for parole. He was allowed to make a statement and said that he felt horrible about what he had done before apologizing to Brittany's family. He stated, I took away Brittany's 21-year-old life, family that she could have had, and I'm accepting the punishment that I've got coming. Brittany's aunt, Kim, also made a statement.
I'm glad that he feels he has a free conscience at this point, but we, as a family, have nothing but pain. We have nothing but daily reminders, and we've had nothing but torture for 14 and a half years.
David Cal was then sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Afterwards, Brittany's parents provided a statement.
You will never, ever stop fighting for justice. Justice for Brittany. We've always said it. I think she'd be, I don't want to say pleased with the outcome because it never should have happened. Like I said, she did everything right that day. I think that she would be grateful to whoever had, you know, helped in getting to today. I don't know other than that. It's extremely difficult to think about that it's taken this long to get to where we are today. If someone would have told me that I would be here 14 and a half, almost 15 years later, I'm not sure if I could have survived.
Having the large family we have, over 14 and a half years, we've learned to be without Brittany. I mean, at the end of the day, our real close family, we're never going to forget her. We still have great family gatherings. In fact, I have our Christmas for my side of the family tomorrow.
Brittany Zimmerman was known for her kind and compassionate nature. She would always go out of her way to help anybody in need. That's why on the 2nd of April 2008, she opened up her door to David Cal and handed him $40. He repaid her for her gratitude in the most horrific way possible by taking her life. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening, and I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Jessie. As y'all know, Morbidology is a one-woman team, so the support up on there seriously goes such a long way. Please do check it out if you're interested in supporting the show. And in exchange for your support, I upload ad-free and early release episodes, bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, behind the scenes, and I also send out a handwritten thank you card along with some cool merch. Can I ask that if you enjoy the show, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you're listening. It's a super easy way to support a show that you like, and I'm always open for feedback. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.